It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, recommendations to bolster the struggling state system of higher education, which is facing declining enrollment and having to increase tuition. And cameras, they're everywhere recording police and public interactions. Officers have body cams, the public their cell phones. We'll discuss a new law and a court ruling. But first, we're going to talk about sanctuary cities, what that term means, what it doesn't mean, what are possible ramifications, penalties, if Pittsburgh does become a sanctuary city. With us is Virginia Alvino-Young, WESA reporter covering race, equity, and identity. Welcome, Virginia.
Thank you, Kevin.
And Bob Bowder, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much, Bob, for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay, Pittsburgh City Council this week held a public hearing on whether Pittsburgh should be a sanctuary city. But let's start with the basics from both of you. What is a sanctuary city? Is there an accepted, a uniform definition, a standard that has been established?
It's there's no legal term for sanctuary cities, and it's just generally accepted that it means a municipality that does not cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
Or does not cooperate in full. Like, there are different, based on what the municipality, what is under its jurisdiction, whether they work with their law enforcement organizations, right? There's all these ranges of what it would mean for a particular city, for a particular county. And it can mean not, you know, fully inhibiting what ICE and federal authorities are able to do within that municipality, but just some sort of limit on the scope of the way that law enforcement would collaborate with those authorities.
Okay, so how widespread is this? And we know Philadelphia is a sanctuary city. And Virginia, you also mentioned cities across the country, and counties. So there are some counties in Pennsylvania that have declared themselves sanctuaries, correct?
Yeah, I mean, Butler, Westmoreland, I believe, California as a state is declared as a sanctuary state. But in general, they are spread out across the country, not just along the coastlines. And there are a lot more counties with designations as opposed to cities or other municipalities.
Is it fair to say that a lot of these cities are in traditional blue states or not?
You know, I really hadn't cross-referenced that, but it is diverse in terms of geography, certainly.
Okay, because you mentioned West, and I think Baltimore is one, Seattle.
Yeah, but there are plenty in between as well.
Okay, so, I understand that Pittsburgh Public Schools is a sanctuary campus. That's plus there are, I know other school, and I know universities are considering that as well.
Have at least considered the fact, right, as well as what that would mean for the institutions.
To protect students who are studying here who might not have documentation.
But again, what does that mean? What can a municipality or a university or an institution do to prevent a deportation or interaction with federal authorities?
Okay, so Wednesday, public hearing by City Council. This was not initiated by council, but rather citizen petitions, Bob.
Yes, a grassroots group gathered the 25 required signatures that are needed to have a public hearing. Council is not considering legislation, nor has it come up at all as an ordinance for council. But they were required to have the hearing because the residents gathered enough signatures to do it.
And there's not a whole heck of a lot of signatures that are required, which is an interesting part of the democratic process.
Well, they did collect, I believe, around 60, but that was right. Obviously well above the 25 minimum they'd need.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. The 25 yeah. minimum, it really doesn't, there's not a big threshold.
I mean, there were definitely more than 25 people there, the majority of them citizens, residents as well of the city.
Now, this might be speculation, but in observing what council members said or didn't say, the fact that the public hearing was initiated by citizens and not council, does that indicate anything like a lack of enthusiasm by council or not? What could you tell from their comments or lack of comments?
I think council, at least some members, feel that the city is doing everything in its power to protect immigrants. And so I don't think they feel it's felt it was necessary to bring up a piece of legislation like this.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what you heard, what you observed from city council, from the people who testified. In fact, let's hear from a Pittsburgh resident, Lillian Bernal. Mm-hmm. She talked about the effects that ICE deportations would have on her family.
I have two young children that they still cry for their father after 4 years. And I really don't want to see more families getting ripped apart. It is very hard to stand here in front of you, but I please ask you to pass this legislation so no other immigrants have to go through this.
Was this a unique message? Was this reiterated by others?
I mean, Lillian's situation, she mentioned that she was a naturalized citizen and had married someone who was undocumented here and that 4 years ago he was deported. So her children are citizens. And she says, you know, we had to face the choice that a lot of families have to face. You either take that risk and go back to your native countries and try to make it work there, where obviously a lot of people are fleeing dangerous situations or at the very least unfavorable economic conditions, or to try and make it work at a distance. And that's what they're doing now. But she doesn't really seem to have a prospect of reuniting her family. So that's certainly reflected in a lot of the narratives that we heard from both people who are here and have become naturalized citizens, or families who spoke as well, women who spoke through a translator that are undocumented.
And they also spoke of fear of being deported, mm-hmm. Fear of talking to authorities. I believe Councilman Gilman said something to the effect that these kind of policies inhibit, say, an immigrant from calling the police if they see a crime being committed, or calling EMS if a family member is having a heart attack.
And I've spoken, members of FURIA recently formed a women's activist group who are often speaking on behalf of their undocumented families. Their one woman told me her house was broken into and that they would not call the cops. And at the hearing as well, there was a lot of mention of a recent study from the University of San Diego mentioning that sanctuary cities in general compared to similar cities had a lower crime rate and stronger economic prospects.
So they're fearful of calling EMS if there's mm-hmm. an injury, a sickness that requires a paramedic, a transport to a hospital. They're fearful of reporting a break-in in the home because they're afraid they might be asked a particular question or to show some sort of identification. But let me get to, what are police, what are EMTs, what are first responders in Pittsburgh allowed to do or should be doing regarding that overarching question about asking for information?
I mean, it's Pittsburgh police policy that they don't ask. That is part of their policy. And speaking with activists from everyone from Casa San Jose to immigration attorneys, they say that Pittsburgh police works with them. They come to Know Your Rights meetings. They have faith in the new Chief Schubert, as well as plenty of the commanders who are coming to their events and working with people as well to sort of try and assuage that immediate fear that comes to so many of these residents who are here in an undocumented capacity. But that's the policy, is that they would not ask. Now, again, where is that line between, you know, to what extent are they collaborating with federal authorities? That's where all of the questions really lie.
And from what I've been told, that also extends to if they make an arrest. Mm-hmm. Say they arrest someone who is not a naturalized citizen, they don't ask them after being arrested, do you have a visa? They don't inquire about that.
And if you're given a citation, a vehicle citation, if they, you know, pull somebody over, can I see your license and registration, and they don't have a license, they would be simply given a citation for driving without a license, as opposed to taking that any further.
So there's no background check per se?
Well, there is a background check, and if there's a detainer out there on this person, they will be detained. But they're not going to, if there's nothing there, they don't ask for their immigration status.
So, therefore, why the fear? Is it a lack of awareness or not enough trust that police, that paramedics, whomever, first responders, will not ask those key questions?
I mean, the fear is pervasive, and so it's really kind of leeching out from there. undercurrent of fear that they're experiencing overall, because ICE is here. The city has confirmed raids and deportations. Again, some members of the community maybe don't know the difference between federal authorities and police. Do they look that different? Do their uniforms look that different to them? The police are approaching them, and they have had family members and members of their community taken away and detained or even deported. So that fear is really overarching and not necessarily directed at Pittsburgh police officers.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about Pittsburgh, about sanctuary cities, with Bob Bowder, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and WESA reporter Virginia Alvino Young. Bob mentioned a little earlier about Dan Gilman speaking at that public hearing this week, this past Wednesday. He talked about being active in the community, doing things in the community, rather than creating a label.
And we need to get together, work with the organizations who are there every day, because that is far more important than whatever you want to call it. Living, welcoming, sanctuary, Fourth Amendment, beacon, I love that term, all of them, it's all the same thing. Don't give in to what's being pushed as a concept and actually dig down into what matters, which are the people in this room and across this city whose lives are in jeopardy.
So that's sort of what he was getting at with the slate of bills that he introduced and were later passed earlier this year, right? Those passed unanimously with council, and they did sort of some ambiguous things like reaffirming the city as a welcoming city, right? Which is really nothing more than a banner, which right. Our advocates are pushing to go beyond, but also did tangible things that they saw as being needs within the community. So creating a language access plan, ensuring city services are being made available regardless of immigration status, tangible things that they're seeing as people's needs that actually do fall in their control that they can make a difference on.
And Mayor Peduto in March, he came out with a statement reaffirming the city as a welcoming city. And he said said that the city would not be a de facto arm of the federal government's immigration authorities.
So Virginia brought up a couple of the things that have been done, steps that have been taken, whether it's another banner like welcoming or actual steps to be more inclusive and helpful in terms of services. So proponents of the sanctuary city designation for the city of Pittsburgh, what do they feel is not being included could be included in that designation?
It's hard, and Gilman speaks to this too, because the county jail is a county jail and not a city jail. If ICE needs to use it as essentially a detention center, well, the city can't really stop them from doing that. They can't go and you know, put locks on ICE's cars, so they can't go and do raids. There's not a whole heck of a lot they can do to stop that from happening.
Well, and he was using that as an example. Philadelphia, it's a city and it's also a county. So they do have control in Philadelphia over their county jail.
Mm-hmm. So I haven't heard. Have either of you heard? Is there any sort of proposal being floated? Because Virginia mentioned Butler and I think Westmoreland County are sanctuary counties. Has there been any mention about Allegheny County considering this? I have not heard.
I haven't either.
If it's in the works, it's certainly not been publicized very widely.
All right. So what are the possible repercussions if Pittsburgh does say, okay, we're going to be a sanctuary city? We have heard threats at the state level and the federal level. There is a bill that has been passed by the state Senate, I believe, in a House committee right now that sort of hangs over the heads of sanctuary cities.
Yeah, it's been in the committee since February. It's just been kind of sitting there. So, I mean, we'll see where it goes. But potentially it could strip quite a bit of funding from the city.
And from counties, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And President Trump has also threatened to withhold federal money from cities and counties that become sanctuary cities. Although the city does not receive a whole heck of a lot of funds directly from the federal government.
Right. It would potentially be at risk of losing quite a bit less than the counties would be at risk of losing. But how viable is that going to be? That's something he was really campaigning on, was these dangerous sanctuary cities, so-called dangerous sanctuary cities. So in his flurry of executive orders in January, something came up that was later limited in scope and narrowed. It was blocked by a judge in April, and just this week, a federal judge reaffirmed that he would not be inclined to overturn that block. So that's held up as well.
And back to the state legislation mm-hmm. that you mentioned was still in House committee and has been sitting there for close to 5 months now. But even if the House would go along with the Senate and pass it, one would think, I haven't heard Governor Wolf say anything, one would think the governor would veto that, though.
Yeah, and his silence may as well be a result of not feeling like it's likely to pass.
Yeah. Okay, so a little bit more about the federal, because Pennsylvania's junior U.S. Senator Pat Toomey sponsored mm-hmm. some legislation, I believe it was last year?
Well, it first was introduced, the title was the Dangerous Sanctuary Cities Act in 2015,
okay.
Reintroduced it in 2016. That was met with a Democratic filibuster, I believe, and died there. There are some complications with how that would intersect with Trump's budget, right? So they're really on kind of parallel planes and not working towards the same ends, essentially.
And so would this even be necessary by supporters of penalties for sanctuary cities? Would this even be necessary under President Trump's proposals?
Like right now, no. I mean, we'll see what happens with his budget. That would really block things like limit things like block grants, right, which would essentially be eliminated by Trump. That was the mechanism that Toomey was hoping to use to sort of discourage sanctuary city statuses. So these are all things that feel a little bit far away.
And hasn't President Trump also said he wanted to cut CDBG funding,
right.
Community
right.
Development Block Grant funding?
Right. Okay, 1 minute remaining. Let's bring it back home to Pittsburgh. Had the public hearing. Is there a next step? Is anybody even saying, yeah, I'll propose it, or no, we're going to just maybe keep doing more things to make it a welcoming city and maybe provide services? What are we hearing?
The latter, mostly. Gilman saying, right, I tried to draft some similar legislation. Advocates and I've concerned with some were against the status. It would potentially put funding in jeopardy. So I think it's really going to be a focus on what are these tangible things that we need? Can we ensure them?
And the city pretty much is doing sanctuary city status anyway. So I don't know that there's an immediate need felt among council members to bring this forward.
Very good. Bob Bowder is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Virginia Alvino Young, a reporter covering race, equity, and identity for WESA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
Coming up, recommendations to bolster the struggling state system of higher education. That's next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zulkowski. Pharmacies around the region will soon offer free drug disposal pouches. The bags allow users to safely dispose of prescription drugs by simply adding warm water. And Pennsylvania County Commissioners were stumped this week by a vague invitation to the White House. Though no agenda was provided, commissioners agreed they'd plan to bring up topics important to their communities, such as infrastructure projects. Find more at WESA.fm.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, a consultant issued recommendations to bolster Pennsylvania's state system of higher education. The 14 state-owned universities, which overall have seen about a 12% enrollment loss over a six-year period. We're going to discuss the stability of these 14 universities, the system itself, with Bill Schachner, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who covers higher education. Welcome, Bill. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And joining us by phone is Deb Erdley, Greensburg Tribune reporter, who covers education. Hi again, Deb.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. A little background for you. The 14 former teachers' colleges brought together by a 1982 state law. I mentioned the slide in enrollment. Do officials have a sense of what's caused that? Is it competition from other universities? Fewer high school grads in Pennsylvania? Let's start with you, Bill.
Yeah, it's actually a little of all of those things. Certainly the number of high school graduates has declined in Pennsylvania like some other places in the country. And there's certainly been population loss in parts of Pennsylvania. But competition is also playing a role in this, too. I mean, Pennsylvania has always been a very competitive market. And when you have fewer high school graduates, fewer traditional age college students, the competition for them becomes more intense.
Deb?
Well, and the state schools are in a position, in a strange position. While they may have still have the lowest sticker price, that Pennsylvania has nearly 100 private colleges and universities, and many of them can offer deep discounts from their sticker price, and that puts them in a really competitive position with the state schools that simply don't have the resources to do that kind of discounting.
So is it competition strictly within Pennsylvania? Is there competition from maybe nearby states that aren't too far away that the students and their families might say, well, okay, if somebody's in nearby Ohio or whatever, is there competition from it, Bill?
It's both. I mean, look at Ohio. Ohio is discounting its tuition for Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania residents. New York State has just instituted a free tuition program for its residents, and a number of the state system schools, Edinburgh and Mansfield in particular, they rely on students from New York State. One other thing in addition to what Deb mentioned is the state system schools are still the least expensive, but as they've been struggling to deal with finances and lagging state aid, they're raising prices. They're moving into things like per-credit tuition, tuition differentials, so the gap between them and some of the other schools is closing a bit.
Deb?
Same thing. It is very competitive. You've got this shrinking pool. And this is throughout the Northeast. Ohio faces this. West Virginia faces it. New York faces it. Ohio's public universities, yeah, they're discounting their tuition a bit for Pennsylvania. But places like West Virginia University are still almost, you know, out-of-state tuition for Pennsylvania residents, when my son, who graduated in 2008, was about the same as in-state at Penn State, Maine. So there is that sense of some competition, but this isn't necessarily students who would be going to the state system schools. The state system schools have traditionally drawn most vigorously from the counties surrounding. And if you look at the numbers in Western Pennsylvania, they're bad. But bottom line, the folks at the state system knew they were going to be bad. This has been projected for a long time. They've had numbers going forward 10 and 20 years for some years.
I want to talk about what the consultants' recommendations are. But, Bill, let's start with you. What was the consultant charged with? What was the mission of the consultant?
Well, it evolved a little bit. When the state system first announced this, they said they wanted a complete top-to-bottom, no holds barred looked at the system that everything was on the table, and they strongly suggested that everything up to and including closing and paring back universities. But if you followed the rhetoric as the time went on, they seemed to walk that back a little bit, and the focus was more on keeping the 14 and making them more sustainable.
Deb, that was one of the key non-recommendations. One key point that was not recommending was the closing of any of the 14. You surprised at all by that, or had it been walked back as Bill suggested?
Not totally surprised, because the places where they've done that sort of thing in Georgia, they haven't seen tremendous savings from doing that kind of thing. And politically in Pennsylvania, it would be a nightmare to close any university. That said, I think the consultant punted to the political side when he said, you've got to change how you do things. You've got to change how you're arranged. This goes back to amending the enabling law, and that's going to take somebody grabbing the ring, the brass ring, and going with it in Harrisburg. You got to have a governor or someone very influential in the legislature who says, yeah, we're willing to do this, and I'm going to be the person who's going to push it through.
And the consultant, in one hand, had some provocative recommendations for things that could be done by changing state law, abolishing the Board of Governors for the state system and replacing it with a Board of Regents, creating a statewide regulatory body that would better coordinate all the higher education institutions. What was not there as much was the meat on the bones as far as things that could be done without law changes. That seems to be left for the final report that's due out in a couple of weeks, and it's essentially going to be, I think, left up at the system to decide.
We're talking about the state system of higher education, the 14 state-owned universities, and recommendations made this week to bolster them by a consultant. I want to hear from Thomas Harnish. He's the director of the State of State Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
Closing an institution can create many new problems for communities, while also choking off access points for higher education for students in rural and remote regions.
Reaction, Deb, Bill?
Nope.
Go ahead, Deb.
I think you hit the nail on the head. You have created all kinds of problems. You're going to have this facility that you still have liability for. You're going to have folks locally screaming bloody murder. You're going to have as many problems. It might create as many problems as it solves.
And as an example, if you're a university that has $80 million in construction debt, you shut down, that debt doesn't go away. It becomes the responsibility of the remaining schools in the system and, by extension, the state itself. So when you really drill down on the idea of closing or paring back, it gets a bit more complicated than you might first think.
You both touched a little bit upon the cost and the competition with other states and even the private universities within Pennsylvania. That 1982 law that I alluded to at the beginning of our discussion established the system so Pennsylvanians could have, quote, high-quality education at the lowest possible cost. But, Bill, you and the PG did a study about the sort of a wide-ranging cost of these 14 universities.
Quite a range. One of the things I mentioned a bit earlier is as these schools were having difficulty maintaining their budgets and the state aid was lagging, they began to compensate for that by increasing rates at a more rapid rate. And it's reached a point where these universities that used to be almost uniform in what they charged, there's now a difference of over $6,000 a year between the least expensive and most expensive. And if you do that, if you look at that over 4 years, that's a difference of almost $25,000. And ironically, the most expensive institution is not the institution that has the most demand right now for students. It's one of the schools that's lost more than 30% of its enrollment.
Oh. So the one that has the most demand would be?
Would be Westchester University.
And the loss of students?
Its enrollment has increased something like 17% over the last 6 years, whereas Mansfield University has lost more than 30% of its enrollment. But in order to do things it needs to do to operate and build, it has now a higher total cost than Westchester.
Deb, we've been talking about the system as a whole and the 14 universities. Do we have a sense of any of them that are actually doing pretty well, that are bucking the trend of lost enrollment?
Well, as Bill said, Westchester is doing great. Part of that's location. Everything's location, location. It's near New Jersey. It's in an area of Pennsylvania that hasn't seen the so they're drawing from New Jersey. It's in an area of Pennsylvania that hasn't seen the dramatic population changes that Western Pennsylvania has. The one that's kind of interesting to me, though, is Slippery Rock. Slippery Rock has managed to hold steady. They've pulled up a little. They're in the middle of nowhere, but I think they've done some pretty effective marketing. I don't know what else to attribute it to.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I think a number of the other state system schools are looking at Slippery Rock and sort of scratching their head, especially in Western Pennsylvania, and saying, how are they doing this? Well, they did that by a number of things, some creative marketing. They really took a look at their retention programs, a number of areas, and over time it's paid off.
Are there any academic programs that are especially attractive that maybe aren't offered at the others?
They've done a look at programs that are not just attractive generally, but have definite demand in their local areas, right? You know, whether it be health sciences, certain business programs, and it's paid off for them.
And what Bill mentions there is one of the places where the state system schools are really behind the eight ball. They're not nimble. They're not able to respond quickly because they have to go through this process of approval, this very convoluted and complex process of of getting a program approved. I would look, go back to little tiny Waynesburg University, probably maybe 20 years ago. They were one of the first places around that came up with a long-distance nursing graduate program. I believe it was a doctoral program that people only had to come in, you know, what, once a month or something, and that just flew for them. Robert Morris did a similar program. Yeah, those programs take time because they have to be approved through a state board, but these private universities are able to react more quickly. The state universities are, you know, bringing up the rear in many cases years later when programs like that are seen to be attractive.
I want to get to some more of the recommendations before we run out of time. And one of you alluded to a recommendation regarding the Board of Governors and whether it should be dissolved. Here again is Thomas Harness, Director of State Relations and Policy Analysis of the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
Pennsylvania has one of the most political higher education systems in the country. While politics will always be a part of public higher education, it cannot be a dominant force in decision making. Most other states do not have such a host of elected officials sitting on higher education governing boards.
Bill?
I think that's a fair observation. And one interesting thing about the system itself, throughout its entire history, there's been this tension between local control and state control. If you go back to the era of 1982 when the law was passed that created this system, the individual campuses saw merit in being part of a system because they felt they had a stronger voice lobbying for funding and support. But at the same time, a lot of them wanted to keep their local autonomy. So there's always been that tension between a strong state system board, weak state system board, and the individual campuses.
And there's also been that tension that the schools that are, you know, keeping their heads above water, maybe not struggling terribly, that they see themselves, there's a lot of tension because they see themselves as having to support the schools that aren't doing so well. And that's one of the interesting things that the consultant had recommended, that the schools that aren't doing so well, let's look at their core mission, and then let's look at how you can leverage their resources by looking at the system. And that's something, he talks about the need for collaboration, and that's something that hasn't necessarily been a big part of this. There's been a lot of competition and collaboration that has been on the back burner, I believe.
Yeah, Deb's right. I mean, one of the common complaints I hear from the individual campuses, especially the ones that are struggling with enrollment, is it's almost sort of a Darwinian environment where the weakest have to try to compete against the strongest, and they don't really have the resources. And again, you get back to funding or the lack of funding available. When things get tight in a state university system and everybody's scrambling, the schools start thinking less of themselves as members of a system and more as independent schools.
We have about a minute left. And so the recommendations, what are the most likely to be adopted? What would require legislative action? About 30 seconds, Deb.
Well, as I said, again, reorganizing along that line with a Board of Regents, that would require legislative action. And, you know, maybe the collaboration and looking a little bit more at more clarity along the lines of communication and leadership, that might be they may be able to do that without any legislative change. But again, that's going to take folks sitting down and agreeing to do it.
And what some people talk about as being one of the fundamental things, rather than just simply funding, is the statewide coordinating board. I spoke with Senator Andy Dinneman yesterday of the Senate Committee on Education, and he says that, yes, the state itself has some culpability in that it has not insisted that the higher education institutions come under a coordinating body of some kind so that they can more efficiently go about what they do.
Who's more – quickly, Bill, who's more like what school might be most likely to reconfigure?
You know – the consultant has not said so. I mean, it's really difficult to say. It depends on how they would evaluate it. But obviously, you look at schools that are struggling. Clarion certainly has been difficult. Edinburgh, Mansfield has lost a lot of enrollment. Cheney.
Very good. Bill Schachner is a reporter for the Post-Gazette. He covers higher education. And also joining us by phone was Deb Early, Greensburg Tribune Review reporter. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the increased use of body cams and a new law about a court ruling that could affect both of them. That's when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, George Washington signs the first presidential pardon in 1795, forgiving two Western Pennsylvania farmers for their crimes during the Whiskey Rebellion. Before they were pardoned, the men, Philip Wiggle and John Mitchell, were convicted of treason for their participation in the rebellion and protest against the whiskey tax. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for July 14th, 2017.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Cameras pointed in both directions involving law enforcement interacting with the public. We're going to talk about recent developments involving police body cams, citizens taking images of law enforcement officers, with Rebecca Addison, news editor, reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. Good to see you again, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
And also in studio is Megan Guza, reporter for Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
So, many developments recently from the city of Pittsburgh ready to deploy additional cameras to a pilot project to equip some state troopers with body cams, to legislation in Harrisburg that'll govern where officers can turn on their cameras, to a Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruling last Friday upholding the public's right to photograph and record audio and video of police officers in public. So let's start right at home here in the city of Pittsburgh. The last numbers I saw from some weeks ago were about 147 cameras to officers and about 150 more ready to be deployed and even hundreds more delivered later this year. Does that sound about right? Is that where we're at right now?
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well.
Okay. So how is the Pittsburgh Police Bureau using the cameras right now? What is there a particular type of officer that's equipped with them or what?
So right now, the Pittsburgh Bureau is protecting its officers by making sure that they give them to bike and motorcycle cops primarily because of recently they just passed that law that would allow officers to record in private residences, but they were unable to do so prior. So that's why they've just been giving them to cops who primarily are operating in public.
Yeah, up until the most recent developments at the state level, like Rebecca said, they'd only been using the cameras on bicycle cops, motorcycle cops, and foot patrol officers because they're less likely to end up in a house, a private residence.
So the interaction would happen on the street, basically.
Right.
Okay.
In addition, a lot of the officers who do kind of the other details, for instance, who work in the South Side, have requested the cameras, so they are voluntarily using them as well.
And I want to get into the legislation that was signed by Governor Wolf, I believe, a week ago. But what were the restrictions? You alluded to it about not being able to go into the home without permission, rolling cameras. This has to do with the wiretap laws. I mean, Pennsylvania has a fairly strong wiretap law.
So, as I mentioned, the police were unable to go into a private residence and just begin recording unless they were actively pursuing a suspect. But now they will be able to, and they also do not have to announce in public that they are recording.
Yeah, this goes back to the mutual consent of recording under Pennsylvania's wiretap law. I mean, when we do record an interview, we have to ask the person's consent on the other line or
the other
end, I should say.
The way the state's wiretap law was written, it essentially rendered this is a complete oversimplification, but kind of rendered the body cameras almost illegal if police were to go into a residence with them on and not
consent. Have the permission. Yeah. Okay. So let's get to the basic. What is the argument for having body cams? Is it to protect police, gather evidence? What's the argument that you two have heard of as you've reported on this issue of police using body cams?
So I've heard a lot of arguments at a briefing in City Council a couple weeks ago. the police officers that were there said that it protects officers in the event that an incident of police brutality is alleged. It protects the officers, and they said that 9 times out of 10, what they've been seeing is that their officers have been cleared. But mainly what I think this law is focusing on and what I think the Pittsburgh police have been focusing on is using this kind of footage as evidence. The one thing that isn't being, you know, talked about is because the footage is no longer going to be required to be released under the right to know, you know, requirements of the state. Now the public will not have access to these. So a lot of people in the public have been calling for body cameras for a long time so that they, you know, would have this footage available to them, and now they're not going to.
So, Megan, is it agreed or is it accepted that body cams, if used properly, if the footage is available, that, quote, both sides, public and police, are in favor of it, or what?
To an extent, yes. Really, the main arguments I've seen, and it's kind of been a step-by-step process. The first step was just, it seemed, getting the officers equipped, and then the next step was to, you know, have the discussion about whether this footage was going to be available to the public. Those two happened in rapid succession. I know the ACLU was staunchly against the ruling that this footage wouldn't be public.
Right. And we're going to hear from the ACLU in just a minute or so. So Pittsburgh is not. Philadelphia has body cams. And just to believe it was last week, state police got a grant to start a pilot project. So now we're going to have state troopers with body cams. It seems like it's going to be across the board. If you can afford it in your police department, you're going to have it. It seems to be a growing trend.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the state police are going to have about 30 cameras now, and other bigger cities have had body cameras for a while. I think we're seeing more and more when there is footage from police brutality incidents, it's coming from body cameras nowadays, whereas before, you know, it was just bystanders taking the footage or dash cam footage.
It's the Confluence where the news come together on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about body cams, police wearing them. And Rebecca alluded to a city council meeting a couple of weeks ago. Pittsburgh Department of Law's John Daugherty said the footage would not be subject to right to know.
In time, when the request is made by the individual for the release of the information, you would go through the various steps of the test. There is no clear black or white yes, no answer. It's all going to be subject to a fact-by-fact, case-by-case scenario.
So how difficult is it going to be for the average citizen to get a hold of this video?
I mean, I feel like it's going to be extremely difficult for the public to have access to these videos. In other cases, we've seen that the police voluntarily release them. But I feel like that's only going to happen when the footage clearly, you know, absolves their officers.
Right. The only time you see this footage released to the public is when something massive happens. And in that case, again, it comes out a lot quicker, it seems, when it's clearing an officer of wrongdoing. I think if you're just an average person who wants to see the recording of your interaction with police, you're going to have a hard time.
Right. And some of the parameters, I believe, you have to make that request within 60 days of the incident. You have to sort of identify what your connection is to the footage. And if you're denied, you have some time to appeal. And there could very well be a fee involved.
And the other thing that the officers mentioned at that meeting again, they said that they wipe footage regularly because they can't store footage for a long period of time. They just don't have the storage space to do so. So while you're appealing, it could have already been wiped.
So 60 days to request, 30 days for an appeal, so it could go within 90 days.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So let's turn the cameras in the other direction. Last Friday, the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the public's First Amendment rights to record a police officer, but with some limitations. it involved a Temple University student. This was the fourth such case in Philadelphia. But the limitation has to do with whether it is considered to be jeopardizing the police investigation or the police. So who's going to make this determination? There seems to be some vagueness in the ruling, whether it could publicize or unveil a confidential informant, whether it jeopardizes an investigation. Sounds kind of squishy there.
Yeah, I mean, that was the first thing I thought when I heard that as well. I think we're going to see a lot of claims by the police that every recording is going to jeopardize investigations.
Right. I have no doubt that the vagueness was intentional. And no doubt there are some cases where, you know, there could be some jeopardizing going on. But I can foresee instances where just existing in the sphere where the police are doing their thing is going to be called jeopardizing one thing or another.
The ACLU has argued that the videos, the body cam footage and the video shot by private citizens should at least be subject to right to know and Freedom of Information Act requests. Let's hear from ACLU attorney Molly Tack Hooper.
Having bystander videos that are available to the public makes up for the lack of video coming from the police departments. So particularly important today in Pennsylvania, since we have a new law that makes it really difficult to get access to body-worn camera footage.
On the other hand, Police Chief of Pittsburgh, Scott Schubert, says officers have a greater latitude to use body cams when they don't have to share them, and body cams specifically can address some of the issues that might arise from video recorded from private citizens.
We have people with their cameras, you know, in their phones. They record 10 seconds of an interaction, and they don't get the entire interaction between law enforcement and citizen. So this way here, we're getting a longer picture as to what has happened.
So, Megan, so Rebecca, is it the two videos of the same incident can sort of help piece the puzzle together, but only if all that footage is available in case something is missed by one or the other? Is that the idea? Is that the ultimate goal?
Simply, yes. I would say that's the ultimate goal here, transparency and accountability. And the director's not wrong when he says that, you know, citizen footage oftentimes doesn't show the whole picture because it usually starts after something's already gotten a little out of hand.
Something that initiated a particular incident.
Right. So, yeah, both of these together obviously creates a fuller picture, but if you're not allowed to see half of that picture, then you've got to go based on, you know, the video, the grainy video posted to social media.
Yeah, I think it's just ridiculous that basically the reason we have body cameras being used so widely is because of, you know, the public calling for them so that we could have a fuller picture of these incidents, and now they're not even going to be able to see the footage.
Megan mentioned the key word, and that is transparency. What does one side, what does both sides want everyone to see? Transparency. It seems like a laudable goal, but under these rulings, under the law that was signed by Governor Wolf just last week, under this somewhat vague ruling by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, are we going to get the transparency that that we want?
Yeah, I really don't think so.
No.
The police, I feel like, are going to use this tool to improve, you know, the job that they do, but I don't think the public is going to benefit.
Right. It was a very brief win for transparency, followed up by a loss. We finally, the Pittsburgh police are going to have the body cameras, they're going to wear them, but no one's ever going to see it.
Megan Kuzza is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Rebecca Addison, news editor and reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance and research from Katie Zilkowski. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.